And good morning. You're listening to Focus 580. My name is Les Schulte. I'm filling in for David Inge this morning. And we continue the discussion on bugs, insects, and the like here this hour. And our guest this hour is another one of our regulars, May Barenbaum. Good morning, May.
Hi. Pleasure to be here.
Nice of you to drop by. Dr. May Barenbaum is professor and head of the Department of Entomology here at the U of I. And, of course, a regular. So if you have questions about bugs, and insects, more along the lines of what kind are they? If you see something maybe you don't quite recognize, maybe he'll give her a shot at trying to describe it to her, letting you know what it is about the life of bugs and how we all interact together. I guess that's what we'll talk about today. So feel free to give us a call at 333-9455. Or again, if you're outside of our 217 area code, you can call 800-222-9455. And May, you were just saying you just got back from a very interesting conference where you gave, I think, a very interesting talk, a very unusual subject, I guess. Maybe it's not all that unusual about cartoons, right?
Well, yes, I was invited to to give a talk at the International Union for the Study of Social Insects International Congress, where 600 plus people from 38 countries who study social insects, insects that live in hives or colonies, all come together. And I don't study social insects. So why was I invited? I was actually asked to talk about insects in popular social insects in popular culture, because that's kind of, again, emphasized to the listeners. I don't know anything practical about insects, how to kill them, how to control them, anything that useful. But if it's useless trivia, I'm your source. So I gave a talk inspired by the weekend opening of the third feature-length CGI animated film about ants, which was, of course, Ant Bully. So mm-hmm. I gave a talk about the history of insects, social insects, ants and bees and termites in cartoons.
And is it very extensive?
It's amazingly extensive. In fact, social insects are overrepresented in cartoons. The very second cartoon ever made was a puppet animation film by a guy named Vladislav Starevich in 1913. It was called The Grasshopper and the Ant. It was based on the Aesop's fable parable, mm-hmm. Which, in fact, was the inspiration indirectly for the two 1998 feature films, Ants and Bug's Life, which collectively worldwide grossed almost $500 million. And these are two movies about ants. It just shows you how powerful the influence of mm-hmm. insects can be in mm-hmm. unpopular culture.
Mm-hmm. Why are we so fascinated with what we think of as their social life and sort of making that sort of crossover to human society?
Well, that's the thing about social insects is that they appear to display all kinds of behaviors that humans can relate to, you know, parental care, self-sacrifice, working for the common good. And what's interesting is how these behaviors are interpreted in the context of the time. In fact, one of the critics, one of the negative reviews of Ant Bully, the gist of Ant Bully is a little kid who's bullied by his peers, tortures ants, and then is reduced to the size of an ant and lives in an ant colony and learns to work with ants. And basically, one reviewer said that it was like a communist propaganda film to work for the common good. And is it no coincidence that these are red ants? So the thing about insect movies is it tends to bring out the tendency to contrive bad puns mm-hmm. in movie reviewers.
So. Mm-hmm. Well, there we go. We have a couple of calls right now. If you have a question for May, give us a call at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Our first call comes from Indiana. Good morning. It's on line four. You are on the air with May Barenbaum.
Hello. Xerxes Society forever.
All right. Yes.
Last time I talked to you, I was talking about midges, and they all seem to have gone. Well, I don't know where the happy hunting grounds are what. But now from my garage position, I've been watching wasps and flies and various cabbage butterflies, various groupings of them. And I was wondering if you could give us some sort of general thing about insect vision, other than they can see up to 8 inches away. Has anybody done anything more, let's say, techie or sophisticated? And if you could do that, something I've been thinking about ever since I was a little boy when I should have become an entomologist, but I didn't. But that's the way life is.
Never too late.
Yeah, I know. I'm working on it.
Well, it's a really good question because people have long noticed the different structure of insect eyes. Insect eyes. I'm sorry?
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Insects have eyes in the same place in their head, more or less, that we do, but they're structurally completely different. They are what are called compound eyes. So there are up to, in some cases, 30,000 or more individual light-sensing units called ommatidia. And it was kind of a puzzle for a long time as to what image was formed by these multiple lenses. And the image that you always see in bad science fiction films where, you know, an ant looks up and you see the person multiplied 30 times on the screen, that is not, as far as modern science knows, the image that insects perceive. Rather, what they seem to perceive is sort of a mosaic of light signals. So if you look closely at a newspaper photograph, it's made up of dots. And collectively, if you step back from it, you see an image from the dots. Well, that's what is people believe is the image-forming capacity of the compound eye.
Can I jump in here?
Sure.
Can we carry this even further? How do they, you know, in a sense, the variables present, how do they take care of them so they know that we have this many-dotted image? What sort of reactions from the insect or whatever? I mean, is it an electronic device, you know, a little electrode stuck in there and they get pulses or what? I'm not doubting what you're saying. I'm just sort of interested in how in the hell somebody figured it out.
Well, you know, it's a very good question. And just to digress for 1 second, for a long time there's a question as to whether cats, for example, could see color. And the way that traditionally color vision was ascertained was that there would be training for a particular reward and in response to a color or monochromatic black and white cue. And based on that training assay, it appeared that cats didn't have color vision. But in point of fact, cats just didn't care about the reward. So, it's and physiologically, it's been established they do have the sensory apparatus that is associated with color vision. So you're absolutely right. We're limited with our technology. But the way this color, the mosaic image-forming hypothesis was developed. It was, as you suggest, based on various sorts of electronic equipment designed to record electric impulses, actually trying to recreate the pattern of light perception that involved in a compound eye. There have been some training exercises as well, particularly with bees that you actually can train and will learn to associate a reward with a particular pattern.
Yeah. Can I jump in again?
Sure.
Just analogically, now, like if you're a birder or into bird studies, you want to get to Cornell.
You bet.
Okay. Where do you want to go if you're into, I know it's a broad, well, so is birds as far as that goes, but where would you go for entomology?
Well, I'm a little prejudiced
I know,
here.
I realize that.
U of I,
I
think.
Following the career. You know, I'm completely sold on that. But I just wondered if there are maybe two or three you could say.
Well, Cornell is my alma mater, and
wow.
I would say it also has an excellent entomology program. Depends on kind of what sort of entomology you'd like to do, because some programs are very strong. And, for example, Purdue has a very strong program in urban entomology.
Yeah. That's where I made my mistake. But anyway, I'll get off. I'll get back to you next time around then.
All right.
Thanks
a lot. Thanks for your call.
Let me just add one thing about light perception. Mm-hmm. There's still things we don't understand. And in addition to the compound eyes, many insects have light-perceiving cells in what we would think to be very odd places in the body. For example, there are some Japanese butterflies in the genus Papilio that have light-sensing organs on structures on the male genitalia. Now, what function they serve, I couldn't tell you.
I don't either. Yeah.
So they're just, there's some things that maybe we, it'll take a while for us to untangle.
Yeah. And I love that scene in The Fly, you know, where you get the little eye thing. You know, I'll never be able to watch that scene the same way again. Let's go to line number one. We have a call in Champaign. Good morning. You're on the air with May Barenbaum.
Good morning. You were supposed to be the good bug person?
I'm the good bug person, yeah. Although Phil really
loves
bug bugs.
He loves bugs, too.
Well, my problem is this. My wife's gardenia is full of aphids, and I would like to be able to attract a jar full of ladybugs. How can I go about doing that?
I'm surprised, actually, you don't have ladybugs right now.
It's inside the house.
Oh, inside the house. Then you'd have to bring them in from outdoors. Ladybugs are kind of a two-edged sword because the most abundant and voracious ladybug in terms of getting rid of aphids that's around here in central Illinois is the multicolored Asian ladybug, which Phil talked about briefly, Harmonia axeritus. And this is...
they hide in the corners in the winter and all that stuff.
Yep, those are the ones. You don't want to bring those into your house because they will establish residence and form enormous aggregations and smell bad and bite you. And perhaps the aphids aren't so bad. And
they make little flies.
Yes, they do, the winged aphids. But there may be some other strategies for using aphids if you want to get rid of them.
Would it be easier just to put the plant outside?
That would work. What would work really well is just as it's getting cooler, you can put the plant outside, and that would likely knock off the aphids. You may not want to wait that long. But spraying soapy water is a really good way to get rid of some of those soft-bodied unprotected sap-feeding insects. What the soapy water does is sort of disrupts their waxy exoskeleton, and they can't take that. So it's non-toxic, makes your leaves all shiny, too, when you're done. So that might be a less toxic alternative for getting rid of the aphids.
Okay, I just throw a few ladybugs on there, and they did a great job, but... Anyway, okay, well, thank you very much.
Sure thing.
Thanks a lot for your call. If you have a question for May Barenbaum, our numbers are 333-9455 or toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's go to line number two. We have a call from Belgium. Good morning. You're on the air with May Barenbaum.
Good morning. I'd like to get to a sad sort of topic, and maybe you can tell me something about it. I've noticed over the past few years here that you almost never see any more Luna moths, the great big moths with the eyes on the wings and just beautiful things. They seem to be totally disappearing. Am I just seeing something that's not true, or is it really something sad?
You know, you're seeing something that many other people have remarked upon. Unfortunately, there are few hard data. I mean, people haven't routinely assayed population densities for these moths, but all around mostly the eastern part of the U.S., there have been many anecdotal observations of the decline in numbers of these spectacular moths. They're in the family Saturninidae, the giant silk moths, and they are, the like you say, the spectacular, just magnificent denizens of the night. You see them sometimes resting on, you know, by your porch light. And there is an... at University of Massachusetts, a fellow named Jeff Bettner has documented that the Saturninidae, the big giant silk moths, are favorite targets of a parasitic fly called Compsolura concinnata. This is a fly that... What is that?
That sounds like a train.
It's a train, yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
it's on your end. Okay, I thought we were... okay, good.
May thought there was a train coming
toward us.
Toward the studio.
No. I live near railroad tracks.
Okay, good. That's a relief. So this parasitic fly is not native to North America. It was introduced in the early part of the 20th century, along with dozens of other predators and parasites, in a desperate attempt to control the gypsy moth, which is another introduced pest. This is a caterpillar, Lyman triad family, that feeds on hundreds of different plant species and devastates the forest in the northeastern U.S. So not knowing any better at the time, people thought it was fine just to bring over everything that was ever recorded as feeding on gypsy moth. So they brought the fly over, knowing that this fly has multiple generations, even though gypsy moths have only one generation a year. So they knew ahead of time that it would have to find other hosts to survive in North America, and it certainly has. And the Saturnias, giant silk moth caterpillars, seem to be a favorite host for this parasitic fly. So that's the problem. One of the, I mean, biological control is a fabulous alternative to chemical control, but it does have, it's not without impacts. Everything we do in the environment has an impact, and this is one unanticipated impact of what seems to be unanticipated impact of an introduction of a parasite that wasn't thought through all the way.
You know, I used to go camping along the rivers here in eastern Illinois, and we'd hang up a sheet with a lantern, and you get the most huge butterfly moths and stuff, and they were just fabulous to look at. And you just don't see those anymore at all, hardly. It's hard to find them.
It's true. There's another factor that might influence the decline of the be influential in the decline of the giant silk moths, and that's generally urbanization and a reduction in the numbers of the tree species that they feed on. But in point of fact, many cities are becoming urban forests, and one of our own faculty members, Gil Waldbauer, has demonstrated that at least in the 80s, you could find more Cecropia moths, giant silk moths, within the confines of the city of Urbana than you could in the outlying areas because of the tree densities. But so it's probably a combination of factors. There's another study that shows the Ailanthus giant silk moth, which is the same family, but it's an introduced species that lives on Tree of Heaven, which is found in a lot of cities.
That's, Tree of Heaven is not a pleasant tree.
No, it smells bad. I mean, but they introduced it into North America because it will grow through concrete. So it grows in the worst possible conditions. You know the book, A Tree Grows in Brooklyn? That was the tree.
Mm. Yeah. Uh-huh. So also, Tree of Heaven will almost never burn. You cut the stuff down and try to use it for firewood, forget it.
That's interesting. I didn't know that. But the poor Tree of Heaven silk moth is very disturbed by light cycles. You know, lights are on all night in cities, and this insect needs to measure the length of the photo period, the light period, and the dark period to know when to go into winter hibernation or diapause. And being in an urban environment has disrupted its life cycle. So that's another factor that might contribute to the decline of the giant silk moth.
All right. Thanks very much for your call.
Sure.
Let's go to line three. We have a cell phone call on line three. Good morning. You're on the air with Dr. May Barenbaum.
Good morning. I have a question, which I don't understand you gave an explanation for. It has to do, you were mentioning a bug had cells for an eye. I don't know if it was on the genitalia or not, some weird place. And you said, well, we don't know what it's for, but I'm sure we'll find out one day. But according, as far as I understand, what evolution tells us is that we have survival of the fittest, but only the fittest in terms of reproductive success. And so isn't it possible that basically in the course of evolution, certain features evolve and they're not doing any good, and so evolution says, oh, forget it, this was a bad idea, but doesn't bother to go back and wipe it out, and so we just keep going along? In other words, you seem to think that, or you seem to state, that there had to have been a reason for it to develop.
No, I actually, I didn't really mean to suggest that. There are many, many examples of so-called vestigial organs that don't appear to play any contemporary function, as you suggest, and they just simply continue to exist because there's no particular disadvantage to having them, which is how selection works. If it's a disadvantage, then eventually those individuals possessing that trait will be less successful and right, less frequently represented in future generations. But in the case of these photoreceptors, they appear to be functional and functioning. And there are some hypotheses. One hypothesis that an investigator named Arakawa has suggested and has some suggestive data in support of is that it's how the males know that they're in the right place. So when things go dark, then things are all in alignment. So there is at least a presumptive function, but this sort of thing is a little bit hard to slam dunk.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. You are listening to Focus 580 this morning. It's 11:26, and our guest this morning is Dr. May Barenbaum. May is a professor and head of the Department of Entomology here at the U of I, a frequent guest on Focus 580. Our lines are open right now if you have a question about bugs, insects, and the how they live, how they function, how we function with them. May will try and answer your question. You can call us at 333-9455, or if you're outside of the 217 area code, our number is 800-222-9455. Just as I look at the temperature now, May, it's 98 degrees outside. You know, we are into obviously a heat wave. Does that have any effect on the insects in our area and the bugs in our area and how they function?
Well, absolutely. Just as the last speaker was saying that there are a million insect species out there and probably a million different individual and unique responses to the environment. So in the case of a heat wave of this sort, there'll be some winners and then some losers. The extensive heat and drought has been associated in Texas. There's just a recent I was afraid we'd run out of insects because Phil went first. So I looked and kind of Google News to see which insects were in the news. And in fact, there was a recent New York Times story about a veritable explosion of hackberry butterflies, 500,000 butterflies migrating. And this has been this enormous explosion of hackberry butterflies has been attributed to these high temperatures and drought conditions, which favor the caterpillars over their natural enemies. So these caterpillars are better adapted to the drought and high temperatures than are their enemies that normally keep the numbers in check. So as a consequence, there are spectacular waves of migrating butterflies, two species in particular. One is the hackberry butterfly. It's a so-called snout butterfly. Feeds, as the name suggests, on hackberries and some yellow sulfur butterflies that are relatives of our common sulfurs that you see in the soybean fields around here. And the butterfly experts in Texas attribute this enormous migration to conditions favorable for the caterpillars and unfavorable for the enemies. Larry Gilbert, who is a butterfly expert at the University of Texas, has collected bucketfuls. I mean, these are choking off traffic. They get on automobile grills and people causing collisions because people are trying to avoid these migrating butterflies. Over 90% of the migrants appear to be males. And this is thought to be because if you're a latecomer male, then all the females in the neighborhood are spoken for. So that's why they're migrating. They're sort of searching for greener pastures, as mm-hmm. it were. So, yes, indeed, there will be winners, there will be losers. Just like it's one of the questions entomologists are always asked, no matter what bizarre weather it is. It's like a very cold winter. Well, what effect will this have on the insects? Mm-hmm. And it's difficult to guess because a very, very cold winter will favor some and disadvantage others. So there's just a lot of stories out there, mm-hmm. and it's very hard to predict because each species has a more or less unique set of environmental requirements.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones. We have a call from Champaign on line one. Good morning. You're on the air with May Barenbaum.
Yes. I've had a question for some time I wanted to ask, and that is that we have a gravel driveway, and when the sun comes up early in the morning and the light comes across the gravel, you see these what look like webs amongst the rocks. And I just assumed to have a web, it must be a spider, but how do these spiders survive in the rocks that get so hot in the daytime, have people walking on them, cars driving over them, and all that sort of thing? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Well, I think so. I think you're right that they are spiders, and I think that they are probably... There are different kinds of spiders. People usually think of web-spinning spiders as making these orb webs up and high in the vegetation that can intercept flying insects.
Right.
But there's another group of spiders called the sheet web spiders that do exactly what you say. They're sort of low-lying vegetation over the ground.
Over the rocks in the gravel. And I don't know what they capture. I never see anything caught in the webs. I wondered if they got pollen or something like that from the trees.
No, all spiders are carnivorous, so they wouldn't know what to do with a grain of pollen. But you'd be surprised how much insect traffic there can be. It's very hot on the rocks, it's true, but a lot of species, particularly desert-adapted species, live in the Namib Desert where the temperature, surface temperatures can be in excess of 120 degrees or more.
Wow.
What they do, these desert-dwelling darkling beetles, Tenebrionids, basically run on their tiptoes or tip tarsi. Because just if you can get up a centimeter or more above the surface, the temperature drops very quickly. So by not sort of dragging their bellies on the ground, they can actually protect themselves to some extent of very hot temperatures.
Well, they have to be awfully tiny, I would think. I've never seen one. And all I see are the webs, and they're always flat, you know, over the rocks, and little tiny things crawling around among these big boulders. I just can't quite imagine how they survive.
About if they are spiders, they're one behavior that many different spiders share is that if a web is not being successful, they'll take it down and move it. In fact, some species will take the webs down, eat them, and then recycle the silk for the next night. Because it is a pretty expensive proposition to make a web.
Yeah.
It's all protein. So there must be,
must be tiny. You just don't see them.
Now there are some other arthropods that spin silk. They'll line their burrows with silk. There's some subterranean caterpillars, for example. But they would not survive in hot rocks. I would guess what you're seeing is spiders, and they can live in some pretty inhospitable places. In fact, I was just talking to Phil about the spiders that are found on the 40th or 50th floor of high rises, which you wouldn't think would have a lot of insect traffic, but they're there reliably. So if the webs are there and they are spiders, then they're probably staying put because they're getting enough reward.
Well, that's very interesting. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for your call.
Bye-bye.
Let's go to line number two, a call from Champaign. Good morning. You're on the air with Dr. May Baird-Mom.
Good morning. I was calling. I have a question about ants. I've noticed at my house in the lawn, it seems like in the summer, on a pretty periodic basis, there's a sort of a small troop of red ants that go off and they march in a pretty predictable pattern. They go find other ant nests. They go in, they raid it, they take a bunch of larvae, and they go back to where they came from, and they do this fairly often. And then I thought I read somewhere that some species of ants actually will take, I guess, larvae prisoners, so to speak. They don't really have their own young, and they essentially enslave them and use them as workers. And I was just curious if you knew about what I'm referring to, and if you could describe it in a little more detail.
Actually, I think you described it very well. There are a number of species that are so-called slave-making ants, and the degree to which they depend on or they will raid other ant nests varies with species. But the most famous of the slave makers is so-called sanguinary ant of Europe, and sanguinary means bloodthirsty, and they earn that name because that's exactly what they do. They'll go into another ant colony. The workers will discharge enormous quantities of alarm pheromone. You know, ants are very chemically oriented, and right. these raiders will come in, and basically it's like screaming fire in a crowded theater or something. It causes chaos and confusion, and in this confusion they're able to capture, as you said, the eggs and developing grubs of this other species, bring them back to their own colony, and then those workers become grow up to be slaves, for want of a better word, of the species that staged the raid. And there is one species, the genus is Teleutomyrmex. It sort of means ultimate ant. And you're right, it has no workers of its own. The entire life cycle is based on getting a queen into a colony and just basically supplanting the eggs there with her own eggs, and everything from that point on becomes everybody works for her. So,
okay.
I'm not sure of the local species, which ones. I think it might be one of the species in the genus Formica, but we have at least two ant experts in my department. So I can check on that if you're if you're interested in identification, it's a little red one, did you say?
Yeah, they're sort of, I guess they're above average in size, but they're red. And they seem to be all over the place because I've seen them in a lot of different places. And when they go, they're pretty active, and then I don't see them for, you know, a couple of weeks, and they go back out again. And so I don't know if they eat what they catch or if they use it, or I don't know what they do.
Well, like Phil was saying, it's very hard to say because what ants eat and how they behave varies with the season and the size of the colony and condition of the colony. It's very hard to generalize about ants. So.
Yeah.
Thank you. They're fascinating creatures.
Yeah, they are. Yeah.
All right. Thanks very much for your call.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
The number to call in the 217 area code is 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Let's go to line number three. We have a caller from Southern LaSalle County. Good morning. You're on the air? Line three, yeah. There
we go. Run on quickly for a couple of minutes.
Sure.
Number one, the first time I ever heard of Cornell, I was out in Bremerton, Washington, and a relative wanted to go there. I don't know, we've lost contact, but his name was Nordby, in case that happened to be a name you're familiar with. The second thing is 50 years ago, my dad was pruning lilacs, which I've been doing for about 33 years, and he ran into grubs. And I have never seen a grub, and I've always taken the stuff down with about 3 years of growth after it bloomed. And the third question is, why are the little, I can't think of the name right now, the little red bugs, little red bugs. They used to be red. Why are they orange now?
Okie doke. I think I've heard of Nordby. Is that the name?
Nordby.
Yeah, but I don't know that I...
N-O-R-B-Y.
Yeah.
B-B-Y.
The name is familiar, but I don't know that
I'll try to check into it, though.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
The lilac grubs that you mentioned... Well, there's at least one species of lilac-associated insect that's called the lilac borer.
I think he might have called it that. But I've never seen him again. Is it when they get into old wood or what?
No, I think it just may be one of these population fluctuation sorts of things.
I'll be darned. Because he used to cut them all the way down, and now I do it selectively.
They also...
I can't even think of it. It fails me. The little red bug that I was talking about, the aphid. Why are they orange now?
Well, that's a tougher one to answer.
I've never seen a red one around here for years now.
Well, let me just briefly go back to the lilac borer. I just want to mention it's a clear-winged moth, and it's a caterpillar-like creature. Lives in ash trees, too. But your question about little red bugs that are now orange?
Yeah.
Is that it? Are these... aphids, or do you know? I mean, it's
I've got a memory loss right this moment. The little red common bug gets out in the yard and it kind of goes around the growth of a tree and that. They always used to be bright red and now they're kind of orangey.
Well, I have I'm not sure whether they're, it could be a different species, but the switch from red to orange is. Could be diet related, I'll mention one example of how diet can affect red to orange color, and that's actually some birds, including cardinals. Lately,
we do have those.
What's happened is there's a plant called Japanese honeysuckle that is getting very, very common. It's an invasive species, and it's consumed by some birds late in the season that have red coloration. And the pigments in the red berries of the honeysuckle are different from the red pigments that these birds have traditionally consumed and acquired in their tissues. Birds can't make red pigment. They get it from their diet. So cardinals aren't as bright red as they used to be in some cases, as are some other birds that have red. So maybe it's a similar phenomenon where the insects can't make their own carotenoid pigments either. So if these... insects are sequestering pigments from their plants, then it could be a different set of plants leads to a different set of pigments. That's my best guess, anyway.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Thanks for
your
questions.
Sure.
Thanks
very much. Let's go to line number four. We have a cell phone call, someone from Joliet. Good morning. You're on the air with May Barenbaum.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Thank you.
this is a question I've had for years, and it's haunted me, and I never was able to get a satisfactory answer to it. But years ago, I was you know, moving some old firewood that was kind of rotten in that, and I came across what was, for lack of a better term, a glowworm. I had never seen one in my whole life. I mean, I've lived in the rural, you know, southern Will County area all my life, and it was just a little worm that glowed in the dark. And I picked it up and kept it around in a jar for a couple of weeks. It lived, and oddly enough, a couple of months later, I found another one laying on a sidewalk, just laying there glowing in the dark at night. And I never was able to find out what it was or, you know, why I've never seen them before or since.
Actually, most likely what you found was a baby firefly, because the immature stages of many species of fireflies, which of course are bioluminescent as adults, are actually bioluminescent as in their immature stages as well, as are some wingless females. Some fireflies that are wingless females are sometimes called glowworms.
It's black and like alternately black and yellow, or black and glowing, I guess, and it was sort of banded with little glowing bands, and you know, at night it certainly lit up.
That sounds a lot like an immature glowworm, and unlike the adults, the parents, which can control the glow and flash on and off, glowworms are pretty much on all the time. They don't have that on-off switch.
Wow.
So it's very likely that's what you found. There are some other species that are bioluminescent in their larval stages. There are some little mycetophyllids, fungus gnat larvae, they're not that common, actually. They're common in caves. And in fact, there's sort of a little tourist industry in New Zealand and Australia where you can take a tour through a cave and see all the glowworms. And they're just these little maggots on bioluminescent strings of goo. And I mean, they're not quite as scenic as the kangaroos or anything, but it's, you know, for entomological tourists, it's wonderful. But we do have some cave glowing fungus gnats, but if you found it in dead wood, it was likely a baby firefly.
I'll be darned. And they're not very common, or are they just...
Well, they keep a low profile, actually.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
They live in moist places, and they tend to feed on soft-bodied invertebrates like slugs.
Wow. All right. Well, thank you for your help.
Sure.
Oh, thank you. There's also, by the way, a glowworm in The Ant Bully. They show up in movies all the time, too.
There you go.
There you go. Okay.
Thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to line number one. We have a call from Urbana. Good morning. You're on the air with Dr. May Barenbaum.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I've been enjoying this show immensely. But similar to the woman with the spider webs in her driveway, early morning sightings have gotten me curious about when I'm driving along a country road and then looking on the plant material that's growing. Every once in a while, there'll be this column of flying insects, and they're all bunched together in kind of maybe a 3 to 4 foot tall
column.
And they're all kind of in a bunch, and then you go for another 20, 30 feet, and there'll be another one. And what are those things? They look very neat in the morning with the sun shining through them, but I don't know what they are. Do you?
Yeah, it's kind of almost like a singles bar. these are... although in the early hours, not the later hours, most likely these are swarms or aggregations of male midges. These are little tiny flies in the family Chironomidae. And what they tend to do in terms of mating is the males will aggregate over a particular spot, and nobody understands exactly what's that so desirable about that spot.
Yeah.
How they recognize the spot, but they do seem to stay rather close to a particular feature of the terrain and form these columns and just maintain almost the stationary position for a long time. And what happens is when females come along, they'll enter this column and eventually find a male. So it's like a mating display of sorts.
Oh.
And it's, I guess, major turn on for female gnats, but it's a puzzle for.
Yeah, but they're midges. It looks like you could just throw a net over them and get the whole bunch, you know, in one really small net. I mean,
yeah, you'd think it would be not a really safe strategy for a little tiny creature to be so conspicuous in the landscape. But but then, you know, mate finding is a needle in the haystack proposition, so you've got to take a risk now and then. And in these aggregations, it's found that the vast majority of males never get to mate at all.
Oh, boy.
Dating makes us do crazy things, I guess.
I'll be a little more sympathetic as I try to catch, but there's quite a few of them in the early mornings, and I've enjoyed looking at them because they're just striking with the sun and the dew and then these columns of insects, and they... Thank you for telling me about it.
Oh, sure. Thanks for asking.
Thanks very much for your call. Let's go to line number two. We have a call from Urbana. Good morning. You're on the air.
Well, I have a question about some ants again. I have small ants that always come in whenever I leave any food around. And they no longer show up. Now we have very large ants. And I wondered if the large ants apparently compete with the small ants, and so they've sort of driven out the small ants, or what you could say about that?
Well, again, there's so many different ants with so many different lifestyles. It's kind of hard to say. The very largest ants in this area are carpenter ants. And it's likely that they are not competing for the same nest sites or the same types of food as other house-infesting ants. What often happens is ants will move in and out of houses depending on the weather. In early spring, for example, before there are a lot of flowers that are blooming, ants in search of sugary secretions will come indoors. But as soon as either flowers start appearing or aphids, because they'll feed on honeydew, aphids show up, they'll move out again. So ants move in and out of houses, much to the annoyance of the people who share the houses with them. So it's probably not, an ant-eat-ant kind of phenomenon that's going on. But just a question of sort of ebbing and flowing of within species variation, which determines the degree to which they're in your house or outdoors.
Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. It's 11:49 here. You're listening to Focus 580. Our guest this morning is Dr. May Barenbaum, and May is the professor and head of the Department of Entomology here at the U of I. We have about 6 minutes left. We can take a few more calls. Let's go to line number three from Paris. Good morning. You're on the air with Dr. Barenbaum.
Good morning. Couple things. The lady that called a few minutes ago that was wondering what the red bugs that had changed to orange bugs were, I was wondering if she was thinking about the Asian ladybugs, because the ladybugs that we were always familiar with around here
that
were always dark red.
Very insightful. And in that case, it is a change of species.
Exactly.
You're absolutely right, because the multicolored Asian ladybug has driven out of existence a number of our native species, many of which were red.
I wondered about that, because I still find the old Arizona local landscaper, and we still find the little red ones, but they're about half the size of the Asian ones.
You know, it's funny.
And they don't bother you. They don't come in the house and mess with you or anything.
What threw me is, I wouldn't describe, I have, from an insect perspective, to me, those are not little. Those are fairly large insects. So,
right. But
you're right.
The ones we have locally are smaller than the Asian.
Yes, they are. And they're way less aggressive. And what happens is the multicolored Asian ladybugs basically clean out the neighborhood of food. So they're much better
starving
competitors. And they crowd out the neighbors. And that's happened repeatedly wherever they've shown to increase in population size.
Huh.
There are many studies showing that as Asian multicolored ladybugs increase in number, the native species decline. And not just the native ladybugs, but the prey species too. The multicolored Asian ladybug will eat monarch caterpillars. It'll eat anything slower than it is.
Wow. That's interesting information for our master gardener group, because I'd never heard that before.
Yeah, they don't just eat aphids. They will eat the immature stages of other ladybugs. They are absolutely indiscriminate and voracious.
Huh. The other thing that I wanted to bring up, it was kind of tied in with the other speaker that was prior to you, And there was a caller called in about using the raw wood chips and getting compost from the local, you know, landscape places, you know, where they take all the rubbish and stuff like that. And we use that in our business. The thing that I have noticed is they have a pile that is really, really old and it's cooled down. And we were using that in a park situation the other day, and there was termites in it.
That's interesting because there was a kind of an alarm on the internet after Hurricane Katrina.
We were aware of that last year, and that's what I told one of the people that I worked with. I said, you know, that just tells me that I use it a lot, but I wouldn't put it up against my house.
Yeah, and in fact, from Katrina, I think there's fewer worries than locally. You know, if a pile has established itself, because the termite colony wouldn't withstand the transport. But
right. Yeah, I thought that was kind of interesting because we used the compost last year and it was still hot last year. I never seen one termite last year. But this is an older pile that has set for several years, has had time to decompose and cool off. Now there are termites in it. So the homeowners, you know, it's great stuff. I would recommend it. But just be aware of what you're getting a hold of and be careful putting it maybe up against your house. And that's all I wanted to say.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you much.
Thanks for your call. Let's go to line number one from Charleston. Good morning. You're on the air with Dr. Barenbaum.
Thank you. I'm wondering how you can discourage mud daubers and paper wasps from building around the ceiling of my porch or near my front door.
Oh, dear. Well, you're asking the wrong person because one of the disagreements I have repeatedly with my husband is that he wants to get rid of the mud daubers around our front door, and I like them. So,
well, I like them except that they frighten people.
But they shouldn't frighten people. The mud daubers in particular, the organ pipe mud daubers, do you have the ones that make those long columns of...
they make big messes.
Yeah, but they don't bother people. I mean...
No, they don't bother me, but they bother my friends who come here. They think they're a wasp, I guess.
That's right.
The paper wasp is there, too, so maybe they think that's it. I don't know.
Yeah, the paper wasp is probably more of a concern, but the mud daubers are extremely, extremely unlikely to sting. And, in fact, they eat spiders. So,
but they make an awful mess on your ceiling of your house.
Well, again, I should put my husband on the phone because this is one of our we don't argue about a lot of things, but he knocked them off once, and I was upset because I actually liked them. So,
well, I know they're a good thing because they do kill other things that are not so desirable.
Well, maybe give Phil Nixon a call at the Illinois Natural History Survey because he has far more practical advice about these things than I do. So he can probably give you some tips.
Okay. Thanks. There's always some sort of trade-off, isn't there?
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Thanks a lot for your call. Let's see if we can get in at least one more call here. Let's go to line number two, and we have a call from Champaign. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. You know, I used to see a lot of the June bugs out. I live about 2 miles outside of town, and I didn't see any this year. However, I saw, you know, numerous more Japanese beetles. I was wondering if there's a connection there.
Well, it's an interesting observation, but I don't know that there's been ever any documented competitive interactions. They do have similar life cycles, the Japanese beetles and the June bugs.
Okay.
But they are a bit displaced in time, hence the name. I mean, June bugs sometimes are called May beetles. They're a little bit earlier to emerge, and they all are sort of grass grubs, these sort of C-shaped, big, fat, white grubs that live on the roots of grasses. But I mentioned the studies of the competitive exclusion in with the ladybugs. I haven't seen studies with June bugs. Again, it may be one of those phenomena whereby Japanese beetles had a better success with the particular climatological conditions we had this year than the June bugs did. Again, that's a Phil Nixon who gets information from all across the state can probably tell you what went wrong with June bugs this year. But as far as I know, there's enough grassroots out there for all of those grubs. So it wasn't so much that one could push the other one out.
Well, very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for your call. And we have about a minute left. May, any final comments this morning?
Well, I guess just to say, thinking about the ant raiders – one very common ant in houses, particularly around kitchen sinks and cupboards, that these are called the thief ants. They are very small, sort of yellowish ants, and they're called thief ants because they tend to rob other ant nests, but they're not enslaving them. They're just like stealing the offspring and eating those. So, but otherwise, yeah, if you want to see the Ant Bully this weekend, you'll have lots of seats in the theater. It did not do very well.
Oh, that's too bad.
Only $8 million box office, cost $50 million to make. So.
And if you want a good read, check out May's books. May's got a couple of books out called Buzzwords and Bugs in the System. May, thank you very much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.